From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. In the poem Fear of Flying, Catherine Coles writes, "All my life, dreams have flown me over the dizzy earth, and her real life reflects those dreams." Coles has globetrotted from Scandinavia to Antarctica, finding poetic inspiration in a variety of landscapes and picking up fans and awards along the way. 5 years ago, she was named Utah's Poet Laureate. This month, she received a prestigious Guggenheim Award. And during National Poetry Month, well, she's been in high demand. Today on the program, Catherine Coles joins us to talk about poetry's power and to share some of her favorite verses. Plus, performance art goes global. Low Lives 4 at the UMFA. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Poetry spans millennia. When ancient worlds recited epic poems to memorialize historic battles or retell mythological encounters with the gods. But how do we use poetry today? What meaning do poems have in contemporary society? And how does poetry illuminate the ever-changing human condition? As National Poetry Month draws to a close, we bring in Catherine Coles to help us understand the role of poetry in our lives and to offer up a few of her favorite poems. And Professor Coles, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for inviting me on.
Catherine Coles is a professor of English at the University of Utah. She was appointed by former Governor John Huntsman as Utah's Poet Laureate in 2006 for a five-year term that is nearing its end. And she's published two novels and four collections of poetry, as well as an upcoming collection of poems titled Flight, based on her experience in Antarctica, which will be published next year. Coles and others will participate in the Favorite Poem Project and Evening of Poetry Readings tonight at 7 o'clock at the City Library. It is the culmination of National Poetry Month. We'll give you more details on that as we go. But how does a poetry touch your life? What's your favorite verse? If you have questions for Catherine Coles, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. And Catherine Coles, before we get into your recent work and into some of your favorite poetry, I want to talk about the Guggenheim Fellowship. Congratulations on the honor, by the way.
Thank you.
You received word that you were a Guggenheim winner about 2 weeks ago now?
Well, it was made official 2 weeks ago. They actually sort of give you a heads up a little bit before then, but it remains a secret.
Ah, so how did you react when you got that phone call?
Well, it was actually an email. It came at 10:30 at night. I was just about to shut down my computer and go to bed, and I was completely dumbfounded. I started walking around the living room saying, "Oh, my God, oh, my God." And my husband said, what?
$45,000, a nice chunk of change. How are you going to use that money?
I'm going to give it to the university, and the university is going to give me a semester off to work on my poems in exchange for it.
All right. Well, congratulations again.
Thank you.
Let's talk poetry. Do you remember when poetry really struck a chord with you? How old are you? When did you realize you had the heart and the voice of a poet?
Well, family lore says that I announced at the age of 7 that I was going to be a poet and a fireman. So it had to have been sometime before that. And what I remember specifically is being completely engaged with books and with literature and with reading. I was just a really passionate reader from a very, very young age. And I'm going to just guess that as soon as I realized that people actually wrote books, I knew that I wanted to be one of the people who was doing that.
What did your parents think of that ambition?
Well, it's hard to say. This was a time when poetry was not particularly visible in our culture. When I was, I think, 2 or 3, when President Kennedy was inaugurated, Robert Frost did read an inaugural poem. But other than that, poets were not especially visible to people. And I think that as I persisted in my desire to be a poet, my parents were a little bit concerned about whether there would be a place for me in the culture. I think that things have changed a lot since then.
Why poetry, though? I mean, why not? So many people want to write the great American novel, to be a writer. What was the call of poetry to you?
Well, you know, I think that the novel, or what we might think of as narrative writing, just exists differently in time and so in the imagination than poetry does. The narrative, it moves you forward through syntax, through time, and you're constantly waiting to hear what the next thing is, what's going to happen, what's going to happen, what's going to happen, is the question. Whereas poetry is something that not only encourages but actually obligates you to slow down and inhabit a single moment in a very complicated kind of way. And as such, I think it provides us the language to understand a little bit more about where it is that we and our interior consciousness actually meets the external world. Mark Strand says in one of his essays that it tells us in so many words exactly where we are. And it's unique, I think, in its ability to do that.
You say that there is wide appeal for poetry today, as opposed to when you started as a poet. What has changed, do you think?
Well, I certainly think that there have been serious readers of poetry all along, but I think that there are various factors that come into the spread of poetry. I think, for one thing, the more fast-paced and urgent our culture becomes, the more people require that ability to sit and contemplate and think about the question of exactly where they are. I think that becomes more and more urgent. I think that the spread of different kinds of media has really helped in propagating poetry. Certainly, I remember that immediately after September 11th, I was on KUER on September 12th in the morning with a psychologist and a historian talking about various ways of navigating and thinking about tragedy. And one of the things that I remember about the post-September 11th days, those early days right after, was how much poetry there was on the radio. Yeah. Auden's poem, September 1st, 1939, was everywhere, but other poems as well. And I think it's because people really needed to examine and to contemplate and to find that space. I also think that poetry slams have been really material and instrumental in creating a wider audience and a wider space for poetry. So I think there are a lot of different things that kind of came together, a cultural urgency, and then the availability of these different ways for poetry to get out into the world.
And you've taken advantage of that new media yourself as Utah's Poet Laureate. You instituted the bite-size poetry project and had videos, 1 minute poems online. You really tried to engage people in a different way with poetry. Why did you go that way?
Well, you know, one of the things that I was thinking at that time is that people tend to think of poetry as being difficult and unavailable, and maybe they had a high school teacher who treated it as a sort of impenetrable code where there was only one way to read a poem, and if you didn't come up with the right answer, you got a poor grade in class. And that's not the way that I think poetry is best experienced. And what I thought was, well, you know, everybody has a minute. Everybody has a minute for a poem, whether they're sitting in the driveway. I know that you did a lot to help us with that project, which was really wonderful. We'd have the poems be read over the radio. Everybody has a minute to click on something, a video of a poem, and just see whether this is a particular poet that engages them, a poem that they might like.
But there is some truth to the idea that poetry can be obscure. It's multi-layered. It's sometimes hard to dig through the meanings of a poem. And I think it does scare away some people.
Well, I'm glad you made meanings plural, because really that's the reason why this idea that there's one right answer on the test, right, is not a great idea. A really good poem will unfold itself to you over multiple readings and in time. And for me, this is actually one of the real strengths of poetry. One of my favorite poems is Sailing to Byzantium, which is one that you and I have talked about a little bit. And one of the reasons that I really love that poem is that I memorized it for Helen Mulder's English class when I was 15 or 16 years old. And it really meant a very specific thing to me at that point. It meant a different set of things to me when I was wandering through the ruins at Delphi in Greece and Ephesus in Turkey when I was in my late 20s. And now that I'm in my 50s, it means a very different set of things to me now. And one of the things that I really think is valuable about poetry and maybe even about, say, returning to a poem or even memorizing a poem so that you can carry it with you is that as you grow, it grows. As you change, it changes, and its meanings become available to you in a different kind of way over time.
I want to get to Sailing to Byzantium in just a moment, but first, reintroduce my guest, Catherine Coles, professor of English at the University of Utah, Utah's poet laureate, and a Guggenheim Fellow. If you'd like to join us, we're talking about poetry as National Poetry Month comes to a close. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Before I have you read Sailing to Byzantium, tell us about William Butler Yeats, the poet, the Irish poet who composed this beautiful poem.
Well, he was a great poet. He began with his feet very much in Irish mythology. As a young poet, he wrote a lot about the fairies, for example. But as he aged, and he did age as a poet, he became a really venerated figure. I think a Nobel laureate was mm-hmm. one of the most important poets in the world at the time. And he also became conscious over time of his position as a kind of public figure and somebody who was making the image of literature and making the image of poetry as he aged. He was a complicated, complicated man. He was affiliated in many ways with the Irish aristocracy, but came over time to support the Irish rebellion, the revolutionaries who were trying to overthrow the England's sway over Ireland. And, you know, so he was a complicated guy living in a complicated time in history. Sometimes his politics were politics that one might espouse and agree with, and other times maybe not so much.
Mm. But in this particular poem, he talks about a journey, a spiritual journey, and to this place where age and wisdom mean something.
Right. And, you know, art was really important to him. And one of the things that he thought about more and more as he got older was what the legacy of the poet is. Some people say that all poetry is about sex and death. And this one has both sex and death in it. Part of the reason that poetry really engages those subjects is that mortality and the question of our mortality is one of the things that is pressing upon us all the time. And so for Yeats in this poem, the question is, what is the meaning of my mortality as a poet? And is there an opportunity for me to have immortality as a poet?
Why don't you read it for us? Sailing to Byzantium by W.B. Yeats.
Okay. Sailing to Byzantium. That is no country for old men. The young in one another's arms, birds in the trees, those dying generations at their song, the salmon falls, the mackerel-crowded seas, fish, flesh, or fowl, commend all summer long whatever is begotten, born, and dies. Caught in that sensual music, all neglect monuments of an aging intellect. An aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick, unless soul clap its hands and sing, and louder sing for every tatter in its mortal dress. Nor is there singing school, but studying monuments of its own magnificence. And therefore I have sailed the seas and come to the holy city of Byzantium. O sages standing in God's holy fire, as in the gold mosaic of a wall. Come from the holy fire, pern in a gyre, and be the singing masters of my soul. Consume my heart away, sick with desire and fastened to a dying animal, it knows not what it is, and gather me into the artifice of eternity. Once out of nature, I shall never take my bodily form from any natural thing, but such a form as Grecian goldsmiths make, of hammered gold and gold enameling, to keep a drowsy emperor awake, or set upon a golden bough to sing to lords and ladies of Byzantium of what is past or passing or to come.
Catherine Coles reading Yeats' Sailing to Byzantium, and your English teacher did you well. You still have that from memory. We're speaking with Utah's poet laureate Catherine Coles about poetry as a way that connects us, as it explains the human condition. Catherine Coles will participate in the Favorite Poem Project, an evening of poetry readings tonight, April 25th at 7 o'clock in the City Library Auditorium. The event is free and open to the public, and there's more information on our website, kcpw.org. You can join us if you like. We're talking about favorite poems. What's your favorite poem, and why do you read poetry? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. The poet Catherine Coles finds her muse in science, literature, landscapes, art galleries, even dogs. Her poems, praised for their clarity, inquiry, and structure, have earned her dozens of honors, from Utah Poet Laureate to most recently a Guggenheim Award. And today on the program, she joins us to talk about the power of poetry to inspire and to connect us. And Catherine Coles is in studio. Coles and others will participate in the Favorite Poem Project, an evening of poetry readings that is happening tonight at 7 o'clock in the City Library Auditorium. There's more information on our website, kcpw.org. So we're talking about favorite poetry and about why poetry draws us in. You can join us. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Catherine Coles, before the break, we were talking about Yeats' poem, one of your favorites, Sailing to Byzantium, and you have a poem of your own that describes a journey that you recently made, sailing to Antarctica.
Yes, it's a very different kind of journey from Yeats's journey. His is a journey of the imagination, for one thing. The poem is very much about mortality and art, as we were saying, and mine was a journey by ship across the Drake Passage, so my concern was mostly just with hanging on.
Give us the backstory. Why were you going to Antarctica? You had received a grant.
Right. The National Science Foundation has what I think is a wonderful program, the Antarctic Artists and Writers Program, and it's a very competitive process. You put in an application. It's read by a room full of scientists and artists in various disciplines, and then if you're very fortunate, they decide to send you to a United States science station in Antarctica. So I got to spend about a month on Palmer Station.
Wow. Well, let's hear your poem and then we'll talk about it.
All right.
Sailing to Antarctica by Catherine Coles.
So it's useful to know that there's a little discourse in this poem about how you measure a sea, which means how you're measuring the height of the waves. And the important thing about it, the important come away from that is that if you say, for example, that you have a 20-foot sea, then you double that number to figure out what the distance is from the bottom of the trough to the top of the wave.
Okay.
Sailing to Antarctica. The problem is the voices I can't get out of my head. On the bridge, the captain's playing Break On Through. He's been playing Stormy Weather. Go ahead. Google World's Roughest Crossing. Google shipwreck and lost at sea. Meanwhile, the ship is tearing itself apart, isn't it? Beam by steel beam. The ship is gnawing its own liver, and the sea is eating its heart out and wants me to sashay right on by and take a look. Lean over the rail, little one. Lean a little farther. The problem is the voices. See, see, you're all foam vanishing, cry of tern and albatross wing knitting you to sky. You are height and depth and open mouth, and I am barely a morsel. See, I can't get out of my head. Or is it, you're what I can't get my poor head around, what I don't know how to measure, a 20-foot sea, a 30-foot sea. Not a falling so much as a career, a sinking so much as a gulp. Measure from where the surface would be if I could find it. If the idea of surface hadn't become a moving target, I plummet past into the trough and know no better on the ride back up into Yippee. Though on the wave's crest 3 days out, I would swear I can see South America. This is the best thing ever. Clinging to the rail, watching another wave crash all the way over the bow. Over the captain high in his bridge, the captain who will carry us through with his instruments and playlist and steel-hulled gut, though he says everyone has a threshold, even him. Chris and Jenny, most of the passengers green in their berths along with half the crew. And me, I am used to the world appearing to wish me well. All those summer weeks spent reading in the Jeep, while Dad careened us down the roughest roads he could find, Mom hanging from some near cliff face by rope rigging. Isn't a mountain a wave moving slow? I am used to the best kind of luck and a stomach that can ride out anything, even the swell of my own hubris. All day I stand on deck with the birds and spray. Birds that can sail across oceans without moving their wings. Wherever I look, infinity's blue and gray, and I say, okay already, give me all you've got.
Catherine Cole's reading Sailing to Antarctica. In the poem, Lean Over the Rail, you really seem to like these places. These very precarious places. it's a theme that you see in your book, Fault. You've written about it in a new poem, Walking the Glacier. It's just that tenuous point between utter destruction and enlightenment, almost. And I just feel like you love that little place. it gives you a thrill.
Yeah. I guess I am a kind of a thrill seeker. I gave a reading at the Kimball Arts Center last week, and one of the audience members at the end asked whether I considered myself to be adventurous. And I pointed at my husband in the front row and I said, well, ask him, what does he think? And he nodded. And I always think that there's a sort of scale of adventurousness. I come from a family. My grandfather was an explorer. He spent, you know, months in very dangerous places, macheting his way through jungles, et cetera, et cetera. And so I sort of think of myself as a tragic falling off of adventurousness within the context of my own family. So context is always, I think, a big part of how you judge that. But I also think that as a poet, I find that the most productive place for me poetically is a place of a little bit of discomfort and a fair amount of not knowing. I think it's always good not to know when you start out on a poem or when you start out on any kind of adventure. It's always good not to really know exactly where you're going to end up. That little bit of discomfort can help lead you to some exciting and surprising results.
Hmm. A beautiful poem that you just read. I'm just wondering about the mechanics. How conscious are you about timber and meter and rhyme and rhythm as you're writing? I mean, do those enter your mind, or maybe describe the process for you?
So I would say that the process at the beginning is very intuitive, that I'm feeling my way into the sound of something and the way in which that sound and whatever the emotion involved with that sound is, the way in which that intersects with something outside, an image, a scene, all of that kind of stuff. But I would not in any way play down the role of craft in all of this. I just think that, especially at the beginning of the poem, you're relying on the craft that you already know so that you're not necessarily thinking about it very consciously. You are thinking about, if you have a rhymed poem, if you're writing a sonnet, say, you are thinking about how you're going to get from one rhyme to another rhyme, which is actually a great way to distract yourself from what you think you want to say and lead yourself into something that maybe you didn't know you wanted to say. But then I would say that as the poem really develops and begins to take shape, you start to think very hard about the poem I just read is broken in its lining very unusually for me. There's a space between every line instead of it being single spaced, which is very unusual for me. And that has to do with the music of the poem, the ear of the poem, and the way, also the way in which I hope that the reader reading the poem on the page will experience the sort of surge and heaving that the poem is actually talking about. And so those kinds of decisions become, as you're moving along in the poem and finally settling on its final shape and its final form, they become more and more conscious, I think, as you go.
The subject of many of your poems is, it's intensely personal. I mean, you relate a lot, as in the poem that you just read. I mean, it's experiential from your bird's eye view. So does that give you pause to create poetry with another character in mind, knowing that your readers are familiar that, you know, a lot of the stuff that you write about has to do with your own life experience?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question, because there have been times when people who know my poetry have talked to me about it and said, oh, the poems are so intimate, as if there's some sort of great amount of self-exposure going on. And I suppose that's true. But for me, the point isn't self-exposure. And I don't think that I'm confessional in the way, for example, that Robert Lowell is confessional talking about his, you know, mental illness or the breakdown of his marriage or whatever. The content of my poems actually tends to be much more abstract and philosophical than that. So that the fact that people experience it as intimate is something that I actually take as a great compliment, because I think it's not necessarily that easy to make thinking an intimate process. And my goal in the poem is not necessarily to portray my own experience, but to create a space that the reader can walk into and have an experience in his or her own right. And if the reader is feeling that the poem is very intimate, I hope that means that I've succeeded in recreating that experience and allowing the reader to participate in it in a very close kind of way.
We're speaking with Utah Poet Laureate Catherine Coles. She is participating in your favorite poetry event tonight at 7 o'clock at the City Library. There's more information on our website, kcpw.org. We're talking about some of her favorite poems. And one that you mentioned was a poem, One Art, by Elizabeth Bishop. Elizabeth Bishop, of course, a strong feminist writer from the mid-20th century. Tell us a little bit about what draws you to this particular poem, One Art.
Well, Bishop was still alive when I was a baby poet, by which I mean when I was 18, 19, 20 years old, and first really coming to contemporary poetry and first publishing my own poems. And she was really, I think, the first living female writer that I encountered. So she's very important to me in that particular way. She's also completely a mistress of the craft. She is so meticulous in the way in which she makes and crafts her poems. And so as a poet, I learned something about that from her. But the thing I love about this poem is how human it is, that it's incredibly well-crafted, which you'll hear when I read it. But it also lets you into some, I think, very personal material.
Elizabeth Bishop's One Art, read by Catherine Coles.
One Art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seemed filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Except the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster, places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and faster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I missed them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster.
Catherine Cole's reading Elizabeth Bishop's One Art. The repetition is so, it underlines everything that she is trying to say. You know, the art of losing isn't hard to master. It will, none of these will bring disaster. And so the rhyming and the repetition for me just kind of hammers home the message that she's trying to portray.
It hammers home the message. And I also think by the end of the poem, it sort of undercuts the message, because I at least I don't believe her at the end when she says, even losing you, I shan't have lied. Right. I think what we come to at the end, we've moved from those lost keys, right, at the very beginning, which isn't
trivial.
A disaster,
right.
Trivial, through things like houses, realms, a continent, right, things that are big but sort of abstract, and then finally at the end to that very personal loss that I think in the poem you can only experience as a grief. And there's that moment in the last line where she breaks it by saying, write it, as if it's actually difficult for her to get to this and articulate it. And so I think on the one hand, absolutely, she's saying, you know, in the grand scheme of things, the world is not going to end because of this. And yet she communicates, but I feel as if it could. Right.
And those final lines, finally, acceptance of the loss.
Right. Not too hard to master, she
Not
says
too
at that
hard
point.
To master. Our time is running short, but I wanted to read one last one of your poems, Cleo at 14. This is just a lovely poem. I'll let you explain it.
Great. It's a sonnet. I, in the last couple of years, have lost two dogs who had come to be ancient, Cleo at 14 and a half, and then Quigley last fall at 16 and a half. She lived another couple of years, which was completely astonishing to us because they're both big dogs and were never meant, either one of them, to live as long as they did. So I had the joy of their presence for many, many years, from the time that they were completely uncontrollable puppies to the time that I had to help them get around. Mm-hmm. This is before I had to help Cleo get around. It's a sonnet. Cleo at 14. This morning, my old collie's full of joy and her own compact presence. Spry at heart, she leads me out, her arthritic canter sailing her up the usual path, aslant. I am full of the past, memory when she could outrun me every time. She gambols when a van of dogs drives by and breaks out, just for her, cacophony. Against the long grasses, she sweeps her sides and plunges headlong down the shrubbery walk, a tunnel smelling of deep green and magic. Later, while I drink my second coffee, she lies on her air conditioning vent. Oh, dog! In her sleep, she wags and wags and wags.
Certainly man's best friend.
Woman's in this case.
Woman's best friend, Cleo at 14, read by Catherine Coles. Your term as poet laureate for the state of Utah is coming to a close after 5 years.
It will be over, I think, sometime early in May. And I actually had kind of an extended term for reasons that had to do with other people and not so much with me. I've really enjoyed it. And
what's been the best thing about being the poet laureate for the state of Utah?
You know, I think for me the best thing is really feeling that it's possible to help people come to poetry who may never have thought that they would come to poetry in a happy kind of way. And I think it's changed the way that I write as well. I mean, in some ways I'm a more experimental poet than I was when I started. And
what do you mean by that? In the themes or in I think just in, breaking out of your box?
I think breaking out of my box. I don't think, when I'm writing a poem, I don't think consciously about, you know, the wonderful people in the church basement in St. George, but they are now, I think, part of my implied audience and group of listeners. And I think that my experiments now include ways to thinking unconsciously, usually, about ways to bring them in to the poem and what it's going to be like to stand in front of them and read that poem and talk about that poem with them. So that's been just a great honor and really wonderful. And I'm looking forward very much with excitement to hear who the next poet laureate will be.
Any advice for your successor?
I would say, you know, get out there, but make sure that you get some rest, especially during Poetry Month.
You have been very busy this month. I'm grateful that you could carve out a bit of time for us this morning. Catherine Coles, she and others will participate in the Favorite Poem Project, an evening of poetry readings tonight, April 25th at 7 o'clock in the City Library Auditorium. It is the culmination of National Poetry Month, and the event is free and open to the public. There's some more information on our website, kcpw.org. Catherine Coles, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
It's been my pleasure entirely. Thank you.
Up next, connecting artistically around the world, we're going to be talking about a new performance art exhibition, Low Lives 4. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. Performance art meets globalization. That's one way to describe Low Lives 4, a two-day festival of live performance-based artworks from around the world transmitted live on the web. Today on the program, we meet the curator of Low Lives 4, as well as one of the participating artists who will be performing live at the Utah Museum of Fine Art. And we'll talk about the international art event. Joining me in studio is Jorge Rojas. He is a multidisciplinary artist and curator. In 2009, he founded Low Lives, where he currently serves as director, producer, and curator. And again, he's here in studio. Jorge, thanks so much for your time.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
And also with us, Michelle Ellsworth. She is one of the participants in Low Lives 4, and she makes solo performance work, performable websites, drawings, and videos. She was awarded the USA Artists Knight Fellowship for 2011, and she has personal ties to Utah and to BYU. She joins us by phone from Colorado. And Michelle Ellsworth, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
Low Lives 4, again, will premiere this weekend. Jorge Rojas will be conducting the video performance art show Friday, April 27th, 6:30 to 9:30 p.m., and again on Saturday from 1 to 4 p.m. Michelle Ellsworth will perform two live performance sculptures at the UMFA on Friday at 9 o'clock and on Saturday at 3:30. And there's more information on our website, kcpw.org. If you have questions or comments about Low Lives 4 or about performance art generally, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Jorge Rojas, I want to start with you. Again, as I mentioned, you started Low Lives in 2009. What's the idea behind this exhibit?
Well, I started Low Lives out of a desire to meet other artists and people in the art world that were interested in using live video streaming websites and mediums such as Ustream and Livestream and those types of channels to experiment with new audiences, to kind of decenter and get out of the traditional places such as museums and galleries, but also to experiment with basically doing virtual performances in real time.
Describe the difference for us between performance art and the performing arts, because I think people may be thinking, oh, so you're shooting live video of ballet or whatever.
Right. Well, I think probably the biggest difference between performance art and the performing arts is that performance art doesn't normally carry kind of the traditional linear narrative that you see, you know, in theater and in opera and ballet and things like that. It's usually tends to be more experimental, It's basically, I think, artists that are using their bodies. The main elements really in performance art are time, space, the artist's body, although the artist is not always present in performance art or is present across throughout other media, and of course the interaction which may occur or may not occur with the public.
And the works that I saw from previous Low Lives events range from dance to mere gestures to somewhat mundane activities like bouncing a ball or jumping on a bed. what are the criteria as a curator? How do you choose from all of these different, I assume they're entries into Low Lives, and what are you looking for?
Well, yes, we do an international call out to artists, and you know, we're looking. This has grown into a festival. It started out as a one-day event, and out of a desire to cover more time zones internationally, and to give more artists an opportunity, because we were getting so many submissions, that we decided to extend it into a two-day event. So, what we look for is really artists that are doing exciting work, artists that are doing new ideas in performance art, you know, kind of cutting edge ideas. Some of the artists are actually using mobile devices to capture their performances. So this year we'll have a lot of artists taking their performances to the streets in New York City or in Australia and in Norway and Japan that are actually using mobile devices to capture. So, you know, we're interested in people that are using new media and this medium of live streaming as a way of doing new ways of experimenting with performance art.
Michelle Ellsworth, I want to bring you into the conversation. How did you get your start in performance art? I understand you studied for a while at BYU.
I did. Dance is my native language as an artist, and so I still very much identify as a dancer, although I am regularly I'm in the neighborhood with performance art, to be sure. And I think the connection between that is, again, the body, the centrality of the body for me. And so early on, my work included technology, and early on, it always kind of avoided, it was a little post-narrative and post-discipline from the get-go. And I think that my interest in kind of a hybrid of or combo platter of forms listed me towards performance art, and I always feel that the fact that I use technology and language and dance was, I don't know if it came out of a fear of not being articulate just as a dancer or what, but it's always been with me. And that's, you know, I've been making that work for a while.
Hmm. I took the liberty of looking at a couple of your clips on your website. You have a whole series called Self-Help, which is really interesting. You've branched out from just your dance roots, but sometimes speak directly into the camera. You're very conversational. I want to give listeners just a taste of some of your performance art. This is just a clip from a video of the self-help series called You Had a Bad Idea.
Okay, so you had an idea, and that's cool. It's cool you had an idea, but you know what? It's a bad idea. You have a bad idea, and I want to be the one to tell you. I don't want to hear it on the street. I don't want to hear you hear it from friends and neighbors or strangers. I want you to hear it from someone who cares, someone who loves you, and someone has confidence that you will, in fact, have good ideas. Again in the future, and someone who can remind you that you have had so many good ideas in the past. So faith in the future and just, wow, in confidence and such feelings of being impressed with past ideas, but dealing with reality here and now. Here and now, the idea you're thinking about is not good. It's weak.
That's Michelle Ellsworth, one of her performance art works called You Had a Bad Idea. Michelle Ellsworth, where did this come from? And from what I've seen of your work, I mean, there's an edge of humor to it.
Yeah, that piece specifically, the this kind of motivational video archive that I've been making. Some of them I made for other people. Some of them were commissioned, like someone was trying to learn to play the accordion, and so I made them a very specific one on that topic. But the bad idea was authentically my own bad idea, and I was just trying to honor the idea of ideas, but move through them. And so those videos kind of, they're part of the performance work and other video work in terms of they kind of make it so that I can move through something that's not functional as quickly as possible. Mm. So that is where that comes from. And with regard to humor, it's odd to me that I know that people often laugh when I perform and that I'm often reviewed with notes of towards my humor, but I actually don't know anything about humor, nor do I have any loyalty towards humor. I'm just trying to, I would say maybe something, it's a little creepy to say, but truth. I'm like actually just trying to tell the truth. And I think that that often lists towards the humorous, but I don't really know anything about it. So I've never been looking for it.
Huh. Jorge Rojas, is that what you are looking for in your, in the video installations that you'll be showcasing during Low Lives, you know, people searching for truth?
Yes. I mean, I think so. Definitely performance always tends to make people think about their own existence in the world, about their own connection to art, about their own truths. And so, yes, I think that's a big part of it. I just wanted to clarify, they're actually not video installations. They're actually...
Their performance is captured on video.
Well, they're live streaming video. And so basically what we'll be doing is projecting on large format here at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts and at 24 other venues across the world, live performances as they're happening in real time around the world, and they'll be just projected and streamed in real time. So it's actually not pre-recorded videos. It's real time.
Real time.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Jorge Rojas. He is the curator of Low Lives 4, which will be showing this weekend at the UMFA on the University of Utah campus. Also with us, one of the artists being featured, Michelle Ellsworth, who will be performing two live performance sculptures at the UMFA this weekend. We'll give you details on that as we go. 801-355-TALK is our number if you'd like to join us. And Michelle Ellsworth, can you give us a preview of your performance sculptures, what people will see when you enter the stage at the UMFA this weekend?
Sure. So when Jorge called and asked me to do this, I was trying to think about the idea of the relationship of live performance in the three-dimensional world being compressed and streamed internationally and what that implied and how I can meaningfully tie my video work to my live performance work. And so in my mind, I quickly envisioned kind of a tutu technology apparatus that I could wear. And so I've made, I call them performance sculptures. It's a performance sculpture that is kind of like a tutu, but it has but there's no tool. It's made out of 1-inch aluminum, and it has a 5-foot wide by 3-foot high screen, and then it has a long tail coming off the back with a projection on it. So there's a projection projecting at my back, and I'm performing in this apparatus that kind of rests on my hips in front of the screen. And so there'll be video content, pre-recorded video content, and then I'll be addressing that content live and moving this rather awkward performance apparatus. But I'm just, that whole question of how do you integrate technology in live performance, this was just another take on it. And it might, physically it's a little cumbersome, but I think it pleases me to wear it and be able to not have a shadow on the screen and just have it right at my back. And I have total mobility of my arms and legs. It's just that I have this 11-foot long kind of, projection screen attached to me.
It sounds like something to see. Jorge Rojas, you mentioned that the medium, some people are shooting what they're doing on cell phones. You're not looking for high-def video content, are you?
No, not necessarily. When the reason we call it Low Lives is when I started the program 6 years ago, I was experimenting with live video streaming, and I was really fascinated with sort of this new technology, which is live streaming, but also it has this low, especially when back then it was all very low tech, you know. So
it's grainy.
It's grainy. It's pixely. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the image will freeze up a little bit. While the sound continues sometimes. So to me, in this day and age where everything is high definition and overproduced and glossy and, you know, in 3D, I find it kind of beautiful to see something that's sort of imperfect in that sense. I think it can be quite beautiful, and I think it really touches on our sort of natural voyeuristic and tendencies, you know, kind of like a YouTube video that's made at home, that's homemade. You know, there's something that's very captivating about it. So yeah, we're not, though this days now people can broadcast with high definition. So it's come a long ways in the last 6 years, we also give people an opportunity to do like high definition stuff, but most of the stuff you'll see will be captured through webcam, and it'll be kind of grainy and pixelated and raw.
The exhibit is Low Lives 4. It's happening at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts this weekend. More information is on our website, kcpw.org. Jorge Rojas and Michelle Ellsworth, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
City Views is a production of KCPW. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.